I think it's important to examine who is on the Hamas kill list and how Israel made the list. And now, thanks to some amazing journalism, now we know. And I think you should know how that label is being applied as you continue to hear Israel's defenders say they are simply targeting Hamas. But Hamas. So much about Hamas. But as you hear that going forward, you need to know what that means. What does Hamas mean? Because what we have found out is that the kill list is being created by AI, by artificial intelligence. And the kill list has 12 times as many names on it than the highest possible number of people who participated in the October 7th attacks.
I am so damn tired of being lied to. I don't think I can deny it anymore.
Hello, my friend, and thank you for listening to the 292nd episode of Congressional Dish. I'm your host, Jennifer Briney. And today's episode is going to be a doozy because I'm recording this episode in late May 2024. It's now been over 7 months since Palestinian fighters broke through the fences that surround Gaza and murdered and kidnapped innocent Israelis, about 130 of whom are still being held hostage in Gaza. Although because of the relentless bombing of Gaza, where the hostages have been held, and the purposeful starvation of the people of Gaza by the government of Israel, which has long controlled Gaza's borders, we don't know how many of those hostages remain alive. But we know that 130 of them have not been returned home. And it's been over 7 months since Israel began its response to that horrible day, October 7th, which was the largest hit that Israel has ever taken in a multi-decades-long cycle of violence. And the Israeli government response has now itself become an unacceptable, ongoing act of violence that has dwarfed the violence perpetrated on October 7th. At the time of this recording, we now know that over 35,400 people and counting have been killed by Israel in Gaza, as the Israeli military has reduced most of Gaza's infrastructure to piles of rocks. It's an unconscionable campaign of revenge that we are now directly complicit in, as our Congress, after the truly horrific level of violence being used by the Israeli government had been well documented and known around the world and credibly challenged as an officially ruled, quote, plausible genocide, unquote, by the international justice system. Well, after all of that, our Congress and President Biden decided to officially, in law and in our names, to send tens of billions of dollars worth of weapons to Israel, which we are currently witnessing being used to continue Israel's destruction of Gaza. And I cannot explain why they did that. I don't understand it. I don't understand how anyone can look at the total destruction of the infrastructure of Gaza and be aware of the intentionally caused famine and think that this is a reasonable response to a terrorist attack. And so I will not try to explain why they did this. But what I can tell you, and what I will tell you, is exactly what they did in our names. And so today, that's the job I intend to finish, as this episode has really become the end of a three-part series. The first episode in this series was Congressional Dish 287, which I titled War Money. And I kind of wish I had titled that episode differently because that episode contains the history of Israel's creation in the land of Palestine. And it's that story as I now understand it. It took me 2 months to research that episode because I knew that I didn't really know the full story about how Israel was created and what it truly is. And the truth is, I didn't want to know. I was raised in a largely Jewish community. I've always had Jewish friends. I have Jewish family. I love them, and they love Israel. They love Israel, the Jewish state, the Jewish country. And even though I'm an American and I believe strongly in our founding principle of separation of religion and government, another truth about my natural bias that I'm going to tell you right up front is I don't really care that Israel, which is a place that I don't live in, I don't really care that it's a Jewish country. Just like I don't care that Saudi Arabia and other countries allow Islamic laws into their governments. I don't live there. And as long as they're not hurting anyone else, I don't care how other countries' governments govern themselves. But there's the rub. Israel is hurting people. Israel is hurting the Palestinians. And it has been doing so since long before October 7th. That's what I didn't want to know. But even before I intensely studied the history of Israel for months, I kind of knew that the story of Israel couldn't be as simple as I was told. I had a feeling that Israel wasn't simply a land without a people for a people without a land, and that the anger towards Israel's existence probably wasn't simply anti-Semitism. I knew there had to be something I didn't know. And ooh boy, I took 2 months to find out what I didn't know, and there was a lot I didn't know. And there's a lot that I now think that most Americans and even Israelis don't know, which I think explains how conversations about Israel and Palestine lately can feel like people are existing in two completely different realities. Because educationally, we are. I was educated in the United States, and I wasn't told that the land that is now Israel was never a land without a people. I wasn't told that people lived there. And when a group of Jewish people, who I will broadly refer to as Zionists, I know there are different kinds of Zionists, but the one thing that unites all Zionists is that they think that Israel should be a Jewish country in that land, in the Holy Land. And Zionists decided that they wanted to take over the Holy Land in Palestine because their Jewish ancestors had once lived there, as if they're the only ones who had ever lived in that Holy Land. But regardless, when Zionists decided to take over Palestine and create a country for Jewish people, they had to push out the non-Jewish people that lived there, or force the non-Jewish population to accept second-class citizenship, which some have. But I had been led to believe that Israel was created by people who settled empty land, and that's not true. Palestinians lived there, and still do. And for Zionists, especially the ones that believe that Jewish people were given land in the Middle East by God, Palestinians' existence on that land, that's a problem. And much as our own shameful history is based on the destruction of a native population in order to take their land and create a new country, Israel is operating on a strikingly similar model. But what Israel is doing isn't a shameful past that can't be changed, as our American history largely is. Israel's expulsion of the natives is a shameful present that our leaders and our money are facilitating. And since there does seem to be some confusion on where I stand on this, let me make it crystal clear up front. Here's my bias. Israel exists. What's done is done. And I am not advocating for a single grain of sand to be taken from Jewish people from inside the borders that the world, via the United Nations, has agreed upon as the borders between Israel and the Palestinian West Bank and Palestinian Gaza. But in 1947/1948, when the meeting place of the world, the United Nations, decided to create Israel as a Jewish country, the very same document said that there should be an Arab state for the Palestinians that would exist alongside it. Today in 2024, Israel exists. Palestine officially does not, which means that the Palestinian people have no citizenship rights in their own country nor in Israel. And that's not right. It's not fair. And that cannot continue. And so that's my bias in telling you this story. I see the Palestinians as people who deserve to be full citizens of a country, whether that means citizens of Israel, an Israel that chooses to be a democracy instead of a theocracy, or if it means that Palestinians are granted what they were promised 75 years ago, their own country, so that Israel can be a Jewish country and the Palestinians can run their country as they see fit. But right now, the Palestinian territory is being wiped off the map. In the West Bank, the part of the Palestine that was not involved in the October 7th attacks, Israel is building thousands of additional homes in illegal cities built exclusively for Jewish people. And in the process, more and more Palestinian family homes are being literally bulldozed to make way for those new, illegal Israeli cities and Jewish-only roads that connect those cities to each other. And in Palestinian Gaza, the Israeli government is clearly making Gaza uninhabitable because the Israeli government has systematically destroyed the infrastructure of Gaza. There are no government buildings left. There are no universities left. There are no power plants or water treatment plants or sewage treatment plants left. There are no fully functioning hospitals left. There are a handful of small, partially functional hospitals, but most doctors are now working in temporary field hospital settings. Entire cities are rubble. Khan Yunis, a whole city, which is Gaza's second largest city, Khan Yunis no longer exists. Gaza is being rendered uninhabitable due to Israel's extreme violence. And on top of that, Israel has built a wide road in Gaza in a strategy of division of territory that they have long employed in the West Bank. But this new road completely divides Gaza into two parts, a North Gaza and a South Gaza. And there are many people, myself included, who are wondering if the people of Gaza will ever be allowed to return to North Gaza, or if we are witnessing Israel stealing that land. Because reducing the size of Gaza has been a stated goal of high-ranking officials in the Israeli government since the beginning of this so-called war. For example, and there are many examples, but I'm just going to give you one. On October 18th, Israel's then Foreign Minister Eli Cohen said, quote, "At the end of this war, not only will Hamas no longer be in Gaza, but the territory of Gaza will also decrease," unquote. And that has already happened. According to the Wall Street Journal, not some fucking TikTok, but the Wall Street Journal, they reported that Israel has bulldozed every standing building, every greenhouse, and every farm within a kilometer of the Gaza border. And Israel's government has said that it doesn't intend to allow the people of Gaza to step foot in what Israeli officials are now calling the new exclusion zone. But what you have to know here is that Gaza is very small, and so that exclusion zone has already reduced the size of Gaza by 16%. And so I think there is a likelihood that we are witnessing the continuation of an Israeli land grab that has been ongoing since the 1890s. And time will tell just how much territory the people of Gaza eventually permanently lose. But since the beginning of Zionism, since the beginning of Israel, the action has been a land grab, an ongoing land grab. And it's wrong. And so that's the spirit in which I'm approaching this topic. Cards on the table. That's how I see things. And if you want more details about what I learned in my 2 months of study that led me to this position, listen to the first half of War Money. The show notes for that episode will further take you down the rabbit hole if you are ready to learn. Then, two episodes ago, in episode 290, I told you about the funding and policy changes for Israel that were included in the National Defense Authorization Act, which gives the permission for our war activities, which became law in December. And I outlined the funding for Israel that was included in the extremely overdue government funding law for 2024, which became law in late March. That's the second episode in this unintentional three-part series. And as for part three today, I'm going to tell you about the funding and policy changes for pieces of land known as Palestine from both of those laws. In addition to that, after I recorded those episodes about the Israel funding and policy changes, Congress passed another law with even more funding for Israel and sort of maybe for Palestine. You'll see what I mean by that. But Congress has since passed the so-called emergency supplemental into law. The bill that President Biden requested back in October, a request that I highlighted in the War Money episode. And so today you're going to learn about what actually became law. But before I do that, I want to remind you that this show is listener supported and you won't hear any advertisements in this episode, nor any other. And that is a deliberate choice. I made this choice for unpredictable, annoying funding. It's not easy to budget like this. But I did this on purpose so that you can trust that whatever I tell you on this podcast is being said because I believe it and not because someone is paying me to say anything to you, which is especially important in episodes like these. Because there is a reason why Americans aren't told many of the realities about the war situations that we find ourselves in. There's a reason why we are only told one side of these stories, whichever side our leaders want to funnel money and weapons to, in this case, Israel. Because as you heard in the previous episodes, and you will hear again in this one, billions of our tax dollars are now destined to be spent on weapons for Israel. And in those purchases, a significant percentage of that money gets siphoned off into profits for the weapons manufacturers. Profits for Raytheon, profits for Boeing. And I want you to think about those companies for a minute. What do they sell? They sell weapons. They sell airplanes. They sell big things. They sell to governments. And yet, have you noticed the commercials for Raytheon and Boeing when you're watching cable news? Have you ever thought about those commercials for a second? Have you ever pondered, what the fuck are they advertising on TV for? Because it's not like any of us viewers are actively shopping for a 747 or a ballistic missile. And so why are they advertising products to us that none of us can even buy? Well, It's because getting us to buy their products isn't the point of their advertising, of course. In part, what they are buying with their advertising money is coverage or lack of coverage, whatever the case may be. Because when an organization like CNN or Fox or MSNBC, any of them, accept advertising, it fundamentally changes the nature of who the customer is for those media companies. You are not CNN's VIP customer. You don't pay CNN millions of dollars. Raytheon does. Boeing does. Every commercial you see is showing you who the real customers are. And no company wants to be known for bad customer service. To serve their most lucrative customers well, the media companies which air corporate ads are incentivized to look the other way. They are incentivized to focus for hours every day on the Trump f***ed up porn star trial or any story that isn't the total destruction of Gaza. And when they can't avoid the topic, they are incentivized to tell you a sanitized version of what's happening in Gaza. Because if they don't, you might not support all of the tax money that's going towards the weapons made by and profited from by Boeing and Raytheon, weapons which have been raining down on Palestinian heads for 7 months. There's a reason for those news curation decisions, and the reason is always money. If I were to sell out, oh, the money I could make joining that game. But, good thing for you, I've never been money motivated. I actually believe there's such a thing as having enough. And when it comes to what I want to dedicate all of my time to, I'd rather spend my time creating a show that makes me a modest living, but serves you well, that serves us well. And so today I will tell you how much of your tax money is going towards bombs and missiles. And I will tell you about the members of Congress whose campaign dollars also make them VIP customers of the corporate media, especially in an election year. I will show you how our current members of Congress have ensured that no matter what happens with the bombs and the bullets, I will show you how their actions in our new laws are likely to ensure that the people of Gaza continue to starve and are likely to continue to be citizens of nowhere, denied the rights of citizenship of a real country, rights that are granted to most other humans in the world. I will show you what they have done in our names, a story that I have no fear in telling because they don't pay me. You do. I serve you. That's how our relationship works. You won't always agree with me. No one does. But you can trust me because I have no incentive to lie to you. And that's because of this honor system funding model that even though I hate having to request funding, it's the worst part of this job for me. But this funding model is at the core of why these episodes are valuable. Your cash ensures that I never have to hide anything from you. And so please pay for the show. I know everyone is strapped for cash right now. I know inflation's a bitch, but please pay what you can. And it doesn't matter to me what method you choose. You can do Patreon if you want to pay per episode. You can do PayPal, Zelle, paper checks if you want to pay by month. You can send in Venmos whenever you feel like it. All of the options are on the support page on congressionaldush.com and in every episode's show notes, which I should mention. I also include every source that I use for every episode in the show notes because it's important to me that our relationship be based on trust. And so I prove everything I say to you. You know you can trust me because I don't force you to. And if you support that, please support Congressional Dish. And thank you, as always, to the producers and executive producers who already do. Okay, let's dive into the darkness. So before we get into the details of the new laws, we do need to talk about Hamas. We need to talk about what Hamas is. And so here's a quick refresher. There are two pieces of land that are Palestine, that would be, should be the country of Palestine, even though those pieces of land right now are not governed as a real country with a real government. They are, in fact, governed separately. And so one part of Palestine is the West Bank. The West Bank is almost completely controlled by Israel. It is occupied by Israel. And right now there is a Palestinian group that co-governs the West Bank with Israel, and that is called the Palestinian Authority. But Israel is the entity with the real control. Israel is stealing the West Bank's land piece by piece. And that is not a controversial statement. That's a fact. The way that this is done is via so-called settlements, which are illegally built mini-cities of Israelis on Palestinian land. There are at least 275 settlements now in the West Bank, and more have been announced by the Israeli government since October 7th. They do not hide this land grab at all. In addition, the Israeli government pays to create Israeli-only roads to connect the settlements, chopping up the West Bank into disconnected pieces that Palestinians can only travel between with Israeli soldiers' permission. The West Bank is not governed by Hamas, and the West Bank Palestinian government had nothing to do with the events of October 7th. October 7th was an act of violence committed by the government of the other piece of Palestine that still exists, Gaza. Gaza is a tiny strip of land on the coast. It's approximately 20 miles long and 5 miles wide, and it is an area that is fully caged in by Israel on three sides and Egypt on the fourth. Israel controls Gaza's airspace, coastlines, water, electricity, and no one and no thing is allowed in or out of Gaza without Israel's knowledge and permission, even at the Egyptian border. And this was the case long before October 7th. But 18 years ago, a full generation ago, in 2006, there was an election in Gaza, and the people of Gaza chose a group called Hamas to basically serve as their partial government, power sharing control of Gaza with Israel, which has maintained the majority of the power. But Hamas is a group that believes in violence to achieve their goals, and they have used violence against the people of Gaza and of Israel. But Hamas is not a government. The best way I can describe the situation in Gaza is that Gaza is the largest prison in the world. Because like I said, no one or no thing enters or exits without Israeli permission, which makes Hamas the prison gang, which runs things on the inside. And on October 7th, 2023, there was a prison break, when at most approximately 3,000 fighters affiliated with Hamas broke through the border fence that Israel built around Gaza in the 1970s. And those approximately at most 3,000 fighters went on a murder and kidnapping spree. And Israel, in response, immediately declared war against Hamas and said that their goal was the total elimination of Hamas. But based on the nature of Gaza, that it is controlled by Israel in every meaningful way, what Israel declared is not really a war, not according to international law. This is the United Nations Special Rapporteur Francesca Albanese speaking at the National Press Club in Australia back in November. And this is what she said when asked about Israel declaring war and claiming its right to self-defense against Gaza.
The right of self-defense can be invoked when a state is threatened by another state, which is not the case. Israel has not claimed that that has been threatened by another state. It's been threatened by an armed group, qualified the way you want, but it's an armed group within the occupied territory. And frankly, even saying the war between Gaza and Israel is wrong, because Gaza is not a standalone entity, it's part of the occupied territory. But so, in particular, the Israel cannot claim the right of self-defense against a threat that emanates from the territory it occupies.
So according to international law, this isn't even a war. And while I do question their true motives, ever since October 7th, Israeli officials have said that the intention behind their extreme violence, whatever you want to call it, they've said their intention is to accomplish two goals. One is to return the hostages, and two is to eliminate Hamas from Gaza. Eliminate Hamas, which clearly means kill them. And since Israel started destroying Gaza, ostensibly in order to eliminate Hamas in the wake of October 7th, I've been looking for an answer to a very simple question. Who is Hamas? Who counts as Hamas? Is Israel trying to kill and or replace the leaders of Hamas? Like, is this a regime change, like when we killed Saddam Hussein and replaced the government of Iraq? Or does Hamas include the leaders plus everyone known to have participated in October 7th, which would be, at most, 3,000 fighters? Or does Hamas include leaders, fighters, and every Hamas politician? Or does Hamas include leaders, fighters, politicians, and everyone who voted for Hamas back in 2006? Or does Hamas include every human male in Gaza? You know, like, that's a pretty wide breadth of humans. So I wanted to know, who is Hamas? Which is important to establish because if Israel's stated goal is to kill everyone labeled as Hamas, how many people does that mean they're aiming to kill? I think it's important to examine who is on the Hamas kill list and how Israel made the list. And now, thanks to some amazing journalism, now we know. And I think you should know how that label is being applied as you continue to hear Israel's defenders say they are simply targeting Hamas. But Hamas. So much about Hamas. But as you hear that going forward, you need to know what that means. What does Hamas mean? Because what we have found out is that the kill list is being created by AI, by artificial intelligence. And the kill list has 12 times as many names on it than the highest possible number of people who participated in the October 7th attacks. We know this from a brilliant and essential piece of investigative journalism published in 972 Magazine, which is an Israeli English language website, and Local Call, which is its sister Hebrew language publication. The journalists interviewed six anonymous Israeli intelligence officers, all of whom were drafted into the Israeli military after October 7th and had, quote, firsthand involvement, unquote, with the use of AI to select these targets for assassination. And before we get into the Hamas list, I do want to just take a second and have us think about who the Israeli soldiers in Gaza are, because who they are college-aged kids. Because Israel has a mandatory draft for anyone who turns 18 and who is not a specific kind of Jewish or Arab. Everyone else, when they turn 18, regardless of how they feel about Israel's wars, has to serve in the military for between 2 and 3 years. And scrolling through the list of the few hundred Israeli soldiers who have been killed in the last 7 months in Gaza, the majority of them are between the ages of 19 and 22 years old. What terrible luck to be in that age range on October 7th, 2023. And I think due to the horror and anger that so many of us are feeling in response to the mission these Israeli kids have been sent on by their government to perform by the monsters in their government, because of that, we haven't really focused on the daily tragedy of their lives being lost or forever changed by injury. We Americans should be able to empathize with their situations. Because after all, my parents' generation, when they were the same age, they were sent to Vietnam to commit horrific acts of violence. In my generation, even though it was not a draft situation, my friends joined the military to protect our country after 9/11 and found themselves participating in horrific violence in an illegal regime change war in Iraq and Afghanistan and Syria. Our soldiers had a mission ordered by the leaders of our government, and many of them are haunted by what they did and saw. Those who made it home alive, of course. And that is happening right now to the Generation Z draftees in the Israeli military. And six members of Israel's military, who may or may not have been serving by choice, were clearly ashamed enough by what they were ordered to do in Gaza over the last 7 months that they decided to speak to journalists. And I'm grateful to each of them for their integrity and bravery. Because the Israeli Defense Forces, or IDF, it's not a military that seems to give a single fuck about human life. And I wouldn't be brave enough to fuck with them. But what these young, brave Israeli intelligence officers told the journalists is that there are at least two AI tools being used by the Israeli military to label humans in Gaza as Hamas. One of them translates from Hebrew to the gospel in English. And the gospel is used to identify buildings that Hamas fighters allegedly operate from. But the other AI program, that one targets people, and its name is Lavender. Now, the goal of this AI tool, Lavender, in theory, is to identify and to add to a kill list all of the people in the military wings of Hamas and the Palestinian Islamic Jihad, which is a terrorist group that partnered with Hamas fighters to murder and kidnap people on October 7th. After the Israeli Defense Forces, IDF, started using Lavender about 2 weeks after October 7th, the tool has apparently identified approximately 37,000 men as being Hamas, which means 37,000 men have been listed as approved for assassination in retaliation for a crime committed by no more than 3,000. And the Israeli military knows that all 37,000 people on the assassination list are not even indirectly connected to Hamas. The Israeli military knows that there are people on their kill list who are straight up innocent, because the IDF knew before they started using it that Lavender had a 10% error rate, meaning that approximately 10% of the time, the machine would list a person that either had a loose connection to militant groups or no connection at all. In the Israeli tests, Lavender had mistakenly labeled police officers or relatives of militants, including their kids. They also listed people who had similar names as militants, and it listed people who had used a phone that had previously been used by another human who was labeled as Hamas. And this made me think of Jaime, because my husband, since he switched his phone number in 2009, has been consistently getting calls for Jaime, who is the guy who had that phone number before my husband and who is not a fan of paying his bills. But if Jaime were labeled Hamas, my husband Joe could be labeled a terrorist and put on an Israeli kill list. You know, that's a pretty big mistake. And Israel's government knew that Lavender was making mistakes like that 10% of the time. And so let's do some math. Because a kill list with 37,000 names on it with a 10% innocent person rate would mean that about 3,700 innocent men are likely on that kill list. And 3,700 innocent men on the kill list? That's 700 more people than the highest Israeli estimate for October 7th participants. 3,700 innocent people on the kill list is three times the number of innocent people killed and kidnapped on October 7th. They know they are killing innocent people. And for the most part, the reasons why Lavender puts a name on its kill list aren't double-checked by humans. According to the Israeli intelligence officers, the only criteria that has been consistently double-checked by humans is the target's gender. If the target is a man, the assassination is ordered. And reporting in Gaza shows us how this is playing out in real life. So let's take Al-Shifa Hospital, the heart of Gaza's medical system, for example. Al-Shifa Hospital was completely destroyed by Israel over the course of 2 weeks at the end of March. Now, it had already been invaded and taken over by Israel in November, and Israel has had complete control of the territory around the hospital ever since. But Israel said that the destruction of the hospital was necessary because there were hundreds of Hamas at the hospital when the decimation started in mid-March. And reports from Palestinian reporters in Gaza confirms that is true. According to Tariq Hajjaj, who is a journalist trapped in and reporting from Gaza, there were, in fact, hundreds of so-called Hamas at Al-Shifa Hospital. But they weren't fighters. They were hundreds of employees of Gaza's government's civil branches, because the local government is operated by Hamas, who is the political party slash prison gang in charge. And those hundreds of civilians who work in government in Gaza and were labeled Hamas were at Al-Shifa Hospital picking up their paychecks. Which makes sense, because how can 37,000 men be militant leaders of Hamas? How can 37,000 people possibly be responsible for a secret attack performed by no more than 3,000? They can't. With a number that large, obviously, regular people who are just doing government jobs are going to be on the list. It's the only way a list that long makes any sense. Branded as Hamas because they work in government, as in they do jobs that the communities need. And in a change in policy starting in October, the Israeli military commanders decided that for every man put on the assassination list by Lavender, no matter his supposed role in Hamas, up to 20 civilians are allowed to be killed alongside him. And if the target is a senior Hamas official with the rank of battalion or brigade commander, which is kind of weird considering Hamas isn't a real government and doesn't have a real military, but whatever. If the person is determined by Israeli officials to be a senior Hamas official in whatever way they determine that, then more than 100 civilians are allowed to be killed in those assassinations. And that has happened multiple times. But let's do that math. Now, since we don't know how many Hamas count as leaders, we will be very conservative with this estimate and just go with the 20 allowed civilian deaths per person on the Hamas kill list. 37,000 men on the kill list times 20 human shields, well, that's official Israeli military permission to kill 740,000 people in Gaza. And so when the Israeli government officials talk about how restrained they have been on their murder spree, killing only 35,000 people, well, they're telling the truth. Because 35,000 isn't even everyone on the Hamas to kill list. 35,000 is only less than 5% of the number of people in Gaza the Israeli military has given itself permission to kill. But it gets worse. Because the innocent families of those on the known-to-be-flawed kill list are knowingly targeted too. The Israeli military, as a matter of open, disgust, and ordered strategy, assassinated the men on the kill list while they were at home with their families, because it was easier to find them when they went home as opposed to when they were supposedly at work together with other terrorists doing terrorist things. No, it was easier to use the vast surveillance network that Israel has long had in Gaza to target the men where they lived. And the software that identifies the men's homes and then notifies the Israeli military when those men arrive home, that software has a name, which is Where's Daddy? Where's Daddy? A name mocking the killing of the man's children when he gets home. It's sick. And this is information coming from Israeli intelligence officials. That name just shows that the Israeli military leaders knew that using an AI program would result in killing children, and they used it anyway. And it explains so much about why Gaza is now in the condition that it's in. Because even if we are going to say that 37,000 men are Hamas and their murders are warranted, which I don't believe at all, but let's go with it. Even if we give Israel that much benefit of the doubt, if Israel gave a single shit about civilians or children, it would use the most precise weapons that it has available and be using the smallest weapon appropriate for each target. Israel has missiles that can target a single apartment in a building without taking the whole building down. But Israel has been using relatively inexpensive dumb bombs instead, which destroy entire buildings, instead of the expensive precision bombs, which can target a single unit in a building. So not only are the families of the men on the assassination list being killed, but so are the neighbors because of the Where's Daddy software. Although I should mention that here we are 7 months later, and the Where's Daddy software, at least, you know, the one that tells the IDF when a man branded as Hamas gets home, well, that's apparently not being used much these days, in large part due to the fact that so few people in Gaza have homes anymore, because most people in Gaza are now living in jerry-rigged tents, and so Where's Daddy isn't all that effective anymore. But can you even imagine another country being so reckless with our lives? You know, it's hard to imagine, but let's try, because this is like if the Iraqi government partnered with the most powerful military in the world and attacked the United States in retaliation for the clearly illegal Iraq war and said that every single person who served in the government during the George W. Bush administration is a Republican and therefore is eligible for assassination, and that the war won't stop until all Republicans are dead. And what if those countries who are attacking us used AI, used some fucking computer to make that list of Republicans who served during the George W. Bush administration and knew that 10% of their list was made up of people who had never worked in government at all? But, you know, fuck it. That's acceptable. Kill them and their families, too. Up to 20 dead innocents for every person labeled Republican would be acceptable. Would we be okay with that? It's hard to imagine, especially as an American, because none of our cities have ever been reduced to rubble by another country bombing us nonstop for 7 months straight. But imagine if that was happening. You personally laying in bed hearing bombs exploding in your hometown for 7 months straight. And then you find out that it's all because government employees were branded as part of a political party, labeled that way by a computer, and are now targets for assassination. I can't stop thinking about this because I live in an apartment building. And if there were a single Republican who also lived in this building, a single Republican living in this building in Texas, I could be killed when they blow up my entire building in an effort to kill that one guy. And maybe there isn't even a Republican in my building because there's a known 10% innocent person assassination rate. It's tough to imagine, but that's the reality in Gaza. Just look at any of the drone footage from anywhere in Gaza and know that we now know how the Israeli government officials can say with straight faces that they were targeting Hamas in all of those bombings. It's because the definition of Hamas is being determined by a computer, and an imprecise computer at that. And it spit out 37,000 names to put on the kill list. And so I just think we need to keep that in mind as we hear the goal of eliminating Hamas being discussed going forward. This is what I really wanted you to know in this episode, which is why I put it on top. Because far too few people are questioning what eliminating Hamas even means. So now that we know that context, which has been widely reported internationally since the beginning of April, let's look at what our Congress and President Biden have now officially done in our names. Let's look at what's now U.S. law. As I described in detail in Congressional Dish 290, Israel War Money, What's Already Law, the NDAA, which became law in December, and the government funding law, which was signed in late March, provided Israel with money for missile defense, which Israel has likely already burned through in defense of the country, which was necessary due to the attack in early April from Iran. We also provided Israel's military with weapons via the Foreign Military Financing Program. But in both instances, Israel was only given the amount that they were guaranteed via long-term, a decade-long agreement, which was signed by the Obama administration. Israel was given nothing more and nothing less. But the biggest change in law that took place before the emergency supplemental was that Israel and Taiwan both became eligible for the program that was created in 2022 for Ukraine, which allows the president to send now all three of them weapons that we have sitting on our shelves on standby for our defenses, and the president can send those in massive quantities. Those stockpiles here in the United States will then be replaced by shiny new weapons that we will buy at full price plus profit from the weapons manufacturing companies, which have our Congress firmly gripped by the balls. Well, since I produced that episode, the emergency supplemental has also become law, and Israel got even more than President Biden asked for last October. So, Israel, of course, got more money for missile defense. They got $5.2 billion for the Iron Dome and David Sling. And that money is for actual defense. And we saw those systems protect Israeli citizens from a missile storm 6 weeks ago when Iran got all missile happy. And so I think a lot of us can and do support that. But unfortunately for the Palestinians, far more of our tax money is now officially appropriated for offensive weapons designed to kill. So $4.4 billion is now going to be spent to replace the weapons that the Biden administration has sent to Israel from our stockpiles. So that kind of gives us an idea of how much has either already been sent or will be sent because of these new authorities. We can now guess that we have sent about $4.4 billion worth of weapons. The new law also is going to send $3.5 billion of your tax money for foreign military financing specifically for Israel. Now, foreign military financing is money that we give to Israel, and then Israel then uses our money to buy their weapons. This money is in the form of grants, which means that it is gifts. There is no payback required. And it says that this money shall be available for advanced weapon systems. And so let's be clear about what this means. You are paying for the slaughter of the people of Gaza. You are, without a doubt, paying for offensive weapons meant to kill for Israel. And that decision was made more than 6 months after the slaughter in Gaza began, after entire cities had been entirely flattened and mass graves had been discovered. And this was signed into law 3 weeks after the world found out that 37,000 men have been labeled as Hamas and have been cleared for assassinations, despite 3,700 or so of them likely being innocent of even being associated with Hamas. This is the context in which much of the world, whose media does focus extensively on the ongoing destruction of Gaza, this is how the rest of the world sees our gift of weapons to Israel. In a lot of ways, from a pure reputational perspective, it would have been a lot better for our country had Congress not f***ed around for 7 months and had sent Israel the money right away, back in October, before anyone could have known how unbelievably ruthless and immoral Israel's government would choose to behave. But instead, our Congress and President Biden, who signed it into law, you know, the man who is supposed to restore our reputation in the world after Trump, well, they made us complicit in the total destruction of a long caged and defenseless population because they sent more bombs after we knew about the destroyed hospitals and mass graves and where's daddy. And when Americans get killed in the next cycle of violence, none of us can ask why. You know, I saw a video today. I don't know if you're following her yet, but you should. I've put her social media in the show notes for you. But her name is Bisan, and she's a girl, I'm going to say she's no more than early 20s. And she has been recording her experience in Gaza. Her video today, she was walking around Khan Yunis, which is the second largest city in Gaza. It has been completely flattened, and she was walking through it for the first time and just documenting her own shocked reactions to the destruction. And the part of her video that took my breath away is as she's walking down a completely rubbleized street, nothing is untouched by bullets and bombs. She runs into a pile of weapons and takes her phone and zooms in on the part that says Made in USA. And then she just talks a little bit about how the bombs are coming from America and it's those bombs that are doing this to their homes. You know, how can we expect any of them to forgive us when we aren't even asking for forgiveness, but instead are fueling the fires in which they burn? I would hate us. Which is why I guess I keep reminding myself that Israelis and Jews are not the Israeli government and Palestinians are not Hamas. Because I am not the Biden administration. I am not this Congress. I disapprove of them so strongly that I can barely stand to watch them work right now, even though it's my job. And yet the rest of the world may target me for revenge because I'm American. Just as Israelis died on October 7th in retaliation for their government's choice to keep the people of Gaza in a cage, and just like Palestinians are dying now because Hamas chose violence. Fair or not, it's rarely the leaders who make these deadly choices who die in the cycles of violence. It's us. And Biden and Congress just put huge targets on all of our backs. And this is one of the reasons why I'm so supportive of the protests. And I do kind of want to see a giant protest at the DNC in August in Chicago. Because the world sees that we are not President Biden when we protest things like this. The world sees that we are not Lindsey Graham. We are not Marco Rubio. We are not power-hungry, bribed warmongers who are okay with mass graves in Where's Daddy? I know that I have more in common with every resident of Gaza than I do with these global elites. And I have more in common with every Israeli citizen for that matter as well. We just want to live our lives. We want to run our businesses, spend times with our friends and loved ones and our kids and hang out. We're all the same. But all of our leaders, it's like they live in an entirely different world. And we're all just insignificant players in their global power battles. It's also Hunger Games. But anyway, getting back to the new emergency law. There was also a massive but little noticed increase in President Snow's power to send weapons to Israel and to other countries, because until April 24th, U.S. law limited the amount of money that the president was allowed to spend on responding militarily to another country's emergency situation without having to go to Congress beforehand for permission and funding. And in those situations, the president had the authority to send weapons off of our shelves and to provide military education and training, boots on the ground, if you will, as long as the total value of the weapons and training didn't exceed $100 million in that full year for all of the wars he gets us involved in combined. Well, the emergency supplemental increased the limit for President Biden from $100 million in 2024 to $7.8 billion, an increase of only 78 times the amount of money that's allowed to be spent by the president on emergency war expenses in a single year. And in a stunning lack of respect for constitutional checks and balances that their own institution is supposed to serve as, Congress also changed the law so that the president no longer has to notify Congress 30 days in advance of making a weapons transfer to Israel, which I'm guessing was probably inserted into this law because President Biden broke this law twice by sending weapons to Israel over the holidays without first notifying Congress. And there was one more permanent change in policy in the emergency supplemental that I think you should know about. The new law changes the law, again, permanently, that required that Israel compensate us for some of the weapons that we gift them, either compensate us with cash or services or waiving some of our debt, some way of paying us back for, quote, at least equal to the fair market value of the items transferred, unquote. Well, now the law, from now on forward, is that Israel will have to pay us back, quote, in an amount to be determined by the Secretary of Defense. And there's nothing in here prohibiting the Defense Secretary from zeroing out the payback requirement entirely. And so, the total for Israel in the emergency law. The truth is, it's kind of unclear because we don't know how much of the new authorities President Biden is going to use specifically for Israel. But if he uses all of the authorities given to him, I saw at least $25 billion for Israel, which is $11 billion more than the president requested in October, with no paybacksies in any form ever required. It's all a gift. And if you see discrepancies with my number and that reported elsewhere, many outlets are saying that the new law only provides $15 billion to Israel, but that's because they didn't catch the change in the law that allows the president to spend $7.8 billion this year on Israel's weapons and military training, as opposed to the usual limit of $100 million. That change wasn't obvious, but you can go to the show notes for this episode on congressionaldish.com and look at my highlighted PDF of the emergency supplemental and see it for yourself. It was a one-line numerical switcheroo buried in a wall of text on page 7. But I added up what I saw by hand, and I saw over $25 billion, the vast majority of that being for weapons of death, not defense. And as for Palestine, in the emergency supplemental, I think one of the reasons that there wasn't much outrage about the law itself is because it was widely reported in headlines everywhere this new law was discussed, that the new law contained humanitarian aid for Gaza. But I am calling bullshit after having read the law. Because while $7.6 billion is set aside for international disaster assistance in the new law, which is emergency food and shelter for vulnerable populations and communities, and while the people of Gaza would clearly qualify under that definition, nowhere in this new law does it require a penny of the money to be spent to help the people of Gaza specifically. And that's the same with the $3.5 billion for migration and refugee assistance. Not one penny is required to go to the people of Gaza. And there is good reason to believe that this money is actually going to be funneled to Israel, because many of the victims of October 7th haven't been able to return home, and Israelis who live in communities that border Lebanon in North Israel have been evacuated for their own safety since October 2. And so Israelis do qualify for this refugee money legitimately. And I think they're the true targets of it because there is a section in the law that expressly allows this money to be merged with the money that's appropriated for Israel. And most importantly, this new law then prohibits any of the humanitarian aid funding to be spent via the United Nations Relief and Works Agency, also known as UNRWA. And that essentially guarantees that the money cannot be effectively spent to help feed the people of Gaza. Now, to understand why I say that, we need to talk about UNRWA for a minute, because this is really important and will have long-lasting effects for the people of Gaza, even if by some miracle, Israel stops bombing and intentionally starving them sometime soon. The United Nations established the United Nations Relief and Works Agency in 1949, 1 year after the United Nations passed UN Resolution 181, also known as the Partition Plan for Palestine, which ordered that two countries be created in the land known as Palestine, one Jewish country, Israel, and one Arab country, Palestine. And as we know, only one of those was actually created. And in that creation of Israel in 1948, Israel took significantly more land than the United Nations intended in UN Resolution 181. And they did so by violently removing Palestinians, approximately 750,000 of them, from their homes and burning many Palestinian villages to the ground. Many of the Palestinians who fled their homes fled to Gaza, where they and their children and grandchildren still live today. And to deal with that refugee situation in 1949, the United Nations created the United Nations Relief and Works Agency to provide aid to the refugees, and UNRWA has been an essential service agency in Gaza ever since, even though it was originally designed to just be temporary. UNRWA is now one of the largest United Nations organizations, employing 30,000 people and serving around 5.7 million Palestinian refugees, nearly all of them descendants of the original refugees from 1948. And its mission has grown. UNRWA, before Gaza was destroyed, was managing 58 refugee camps and 715 schools for more than 500,000 boys and girls in Gaza, the West Bank, East Jerusalem, Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan. And our Congress has chosen to pull a Tanya Harding and take UNRWA out at the knees, right when it's needed to be at its peak performance. First, the funding law, which was signed in March, prohibited any funding for UNRWA until March 25th, 2025. And then the emergency supplemental, as you just heard, prohibits UNRWA from distributing any aid that might, but is not required, to be spent in Gaza. Now, the DC wisdom behind why Congress did this, and the timing lines up perfectly with this accusation, but the reason our gullible members of Congress defunded UNRWA and is prohibiting it from participating in delivering aid is because in mid-February, Israel's government accused approximately a dozen UNRWA employees. Out of 30,000, a dozen of them were accused of participating in the October 7th attacks. And countries all over the world took Israel's government at its word and immediately cut off funding to UNRWA, President Biden included. But since that accusation, Israel has not been able to produce one bit of evidence to back up that claim, and there have been independent investigations completed that couldn't find any evidence either. As a result, other countries have resumed their funding for UNRWA, but our Congress decided to defund the agency by law for a year. And so to explain why that is such a big fucking deal, I want to play some highlights for you from a April 10th Foreign Affairs Committee hearing, during which the witness was Samantha Power. She is the Biden administration's USAID administrator. And so first up, here's Representative Joaquin Castro of Texas asking about the situation on the ground in Gaza.
I want to ask you, obviously, about the very urgent situation, humanitarian situation in Gaza. In your testimony, you said that the entire population of Gaza is living under the threat of famine. News reports came out recently that certain USAID officials sent a cable to the National Security Council warning that famine is already likely occurring in parts of the Gaza Strip. According to the report, quote, famine conditions are most severe and widespread in northern Gaza, which is under Israeli control. Do you think that it's plausible or likely that parts of Gaza, and particularly northern Gaza, are already experiencing famine?
Well, the methodology that the IPC used is one that we had our experts scrub. It's one that's relied upon in other settings, and that is their assessment, and we believe that assessment is credible.
So there's famine is already occurring there?
That is,
yeah.
Yes.
Okay. And more than half of the population of Gaza is under the age of 18, as you know, and are seriously affected by the lack of access to food and nutrition. And various organizations, including the United Nations, have warned that hundreds of thousands of Palestinian children may die if they don't get necessary food and nutrition assistance in just the next 2 to 3 weeks. Has USAID made such an assessment itself? And do you have a sense of how many such children might be at risk of dying if they don't get access to food and nutrition that's currently unavailable?
I do not have those assessments on hand, but I will say that in northern Gaza, the rate of malnutrition prior to October 7th was almost zero, and it is now one in three kids. But extrapolating out is hard. And I will say, just with some humility, because it is so hard to move around in Gaza, because the access challenges that give rise in part to the malnutrition are so severe, it is also, you know, hard to do the kind of scaled assessments that we would wish to do. But in terms of actual severe acute malnutrition for under fives, that rate was 16% in January and became 30% in February. And we're awaiting the March numbers, but we expect it to continue.
So it got markedly worse.
Yeah, markedly worse, but extrapolating and giving you the overall numbers.
And just to be clear, I realize you're not part of the DOD or you know, the State Department working on these issues diplomatically. But is it your understanding that humanitarian assistance and food assistance is not supposed to be denied even when countries are at war with each other? Because there is this argument that, well, if Hamas would release the hostages, if they would surrender, that this would stop. But there's certain laws of war and certain conduct that nations are supposed to follow, and that includes allowing for humanitarian assistance.
Correct. I mean, I will say, of course, and we all agree, the hostages should be released.
Absolutely.
It's an absolute outrage that they have been kept this long, and the horror and terror for the families of those individuals I can't even contemplate. But yes, food must flow.
But
and
kids
not,
can't be starved because you have two groups that are at war with each other.
Food must flow, and food has not flowed in sufficient quantities to avoid this imminent famine in the South and these conditions that are giving rise already to child deaths in the North.
So that is what the Biden administration officials had to acknowledge was the situation on the ground almost 2 months ago. And I've been following the situation obsessively, and I promise you, it hasn't gotten any better since. And so aid is needed. It's not fake news. Famine is confirmed. And so what does UNRWA have to do with that? Well, here's Representative Madeline Dean of Pennsylvania speaking to USAID Administrator Samantha Power.
I am hypercritical of the alleged 12 or 15 who may have been infiltrating as Hamas, who may have participated in the October 7th horrendous, barbaric attack. But you don't throw everybody and all the good work out. Because I want to ask you, if we continue this pause, if the world said we will not help you, UNRWA, your however thousands of workers who are on the ground who keep coming to work even when their families, whole families, are killed, what will happen with famine in Gaza if we just shut it down? No more UNRWA. By the way, they're not educating. We know that. They can't even do that now. They have incredibly important vaccines and medical aid to be a part of, but the essentialness of food and water. What happens if we continue this disinformation campaign of defund UNRWA?
Well, first, thank you for bringing some facts into the conversation that I probably should have raised before, including just the horrific loss of life for those who work for UNRWA, and in general, you know, more than 220 aid workers killed by IDF or in IDF military operations to this point, including most recently, of course, the World Central Kitchen colleagues, devastatingly. And thank you also for reminding us all, but UNRWA is an organization in Gaza alone of 13,000 people.
Right.
And the vast majority of those people have, you know, not been propagating hate, but have been actually trying to educate young people. The literacy rate in Gaza, I think, is something like 99%.
Astounding.
It's one of the most, I should say, Gaza West Bank. It's one of the most effective literacy efforts, you know, in any of the places that USAID works. In terms of what would happen if the whole thing shut down, right now it looks like other countries are stepping up to avert that scenario. But, you know, I just cannot overstate how chaotic and how horrific the conditions in Gaza are. You've spoken to them. The visuals speak to the level of destruction. There's no workaround for the infrastructure that they provide now. You know, after the war, when there's a new administration of Gaza, if that comes about, obviously that's itself extremely complicated. You know, the question of who is providing education as they try to rebuild virtually everything from scratch in the education and the health sector, you know, some of these questions will be addressed. But right now, there is no way to avert large-scale famine without relying on the humanitarian backbone that has been UNRWA for decades and that remains UNRWA today. That doesn't mean, again, that, I mean, we are going to follow the law. We are going to work through other partners. But even as I started to say this earlier, even the government of Israel, which had banned UNRWA participation in convoys because of the food crisis and U.S. engagement, I hope, has now decided that UNRWA can, in fact, be part of convoys going to the north because they recognize there's just no other way.
Right.
We need UNRWA to deliver our aid. There's, quote, just no other way. And there is no organization that we have, even outside the government, that can take UNRWA's place.
You know, you know well, because you've been in so many of these countries, we don't have an NGO out there or another. This is not your traditional UN agency where you can have like schools in a box, you know, teachers in a box, health workers in a box. They were almost like Hamas was the state, and Hamas won the election back in the day, and Hamas, you know, obviously had far too much influence on certain individuals, or even certain individuals were it seems like potentially part of Hamas. But the fact is, the administration of schools and health systems was UNRWA. And it's, and there's not an NGO or another UN agency that could perform the function of a state like that, or at least I haven't encountered one in my years of humanitarian service.
UNRWA is the only functional aid delivery organization that can get the food and water and medicine where it needs to go and do it now, which makes Congress and President Biden's 1-2 legislative punch against UNRWA so vicious to the people of Gaza. Because first, they defund it for a full year until March 25th, 2025, which is a significant hit to its overall funding. The United States is by far the largest contributor to UNRWA, and so while UNRWA is facing unprecedented, unimaginable challenges, including the destruction of its infrastructure and the death of its own employees in Gaza, it's also supposed to operate on a budget that's been cut by us by 30%. And then, punch number two, the aid money that might come from us to Gaza directly can't be distributed by UNRWA. So how the fuck is it supposed to get to the people who need it? That provision is cruel beyond my wildest imagination, because even if the bombs stop falling and food and water arrives at the gate of Gaza's hell, we won't let the helpers get it to where it needs to go. Not that I think the money is intended for Gaza anyway, like I said. But Congress and President Biden got their headlines that said help is on the way to Gaza, and no one seems to be the wiser, so there's very little outrage about this. It's just another shameful example of the danger to our collective knowledge about our role in the world when journalists don't bother to read the fucking laws they report on. Another provision in our law that's going to have long-term consequences is the one that puts up hurdles that the Palestinians will need to jump through before they can live and thrive in a real country of their own. Section 7037 of the 2024 government funding law says that money is prohibited from being used to make Palestine a real country unless the Secretary of State certifies that the would-be government of Palestine has done a bunch of things. So first, they would have to demonstrate a firm commitment to peaceful coexistence with the State of Israel. Fine. They would also have to cooperate with Israeli security organizations to counter terrorism and terrorism financing in the West Bank and Gaza. So they would have to partner with the very forces that have been controlling, caging, starving, and killing them. And speaking of Israel, the government of Palestine would also have to commit to respect and acknowledge the sovereignty and territorial integrity of every state in the area, and respect and acknowledge, quote, their right to live in peace within secure and recognized boundaries, free from threats or acts of force, unquote. They would have to allow freedom of navigation through international waterways of the area, and they would have to create a framework for achieving a just settlement of the refugee problem. And then there's also a sense of Congress that says that Congress believes that the governing entity should enact a constitution, assuring the rule of law, an independent judiciary, and respect for human rights for its citizens. And that is like projection in law. Because Israel, the country with power, doesn't respect the border of its neighbors. Forget about its history in which it stole land from literally every single one of its neighboring countries. Right now, Israel is constantly stealing land from the West Bank, and this isn't brought up much because the focus is rightfully on the Palestinians right now, but Israel is also stealing the Golan Heights, which is part of Syria. The point is that the Palestinians are not the only ones who urgently need conditions in law to force them to respect territorial boundaries. Israel, the country with real power, also doesn't allow the Palestinians any kind of freedom of navigation or fishing or fossil fuel access in the waters off their coast. But our law says it's the Palestinians who need to allow freedom of navigation in the water. Why is it the Palestinians who must create a framework for managing power that they don't have? This provision is also more aptly applied to Israel. And then Israel, the real country with real power, which created the refugee problem, is also not charged with solving it. Instead, it's the Palestinians who are caged, who are required by U.S. law to solve the problem they did not create. And then finally, Congress says that the Palestinians should create a constitution with an independent judiciary ensuring respect for human rights. Which, sure, fine, that's all good. But you know who hasn't done that yet? Israel. Even though when Israel was created, its own Declaration of Independence required a constitution to be finished by October 1st, 1948, which means that it's over 70 years overdue. And in the months before October 7th, the people of Israel were protesting in huge numbers because their independent judiciary was being destroyed because it dared to rule independently. And so if we're going to require the Palestinians to create a constitution that ensures an independent judiciary, it's also appropriate to include Israel in that requirement as well. And guarantees of human rights? Are you serious? Israel has over 2 million people locked in a large cage in Gaza and has been bombing and starving them for months. All of these provisions were applied to Palestine if it wants to be a country, and that's fine. But these conditions are so clearly needed in regards to Israel, and yet Israel remains exempt. How can there ever be peace and respect as neighboring countries if these very basic conditions only apply to one side, the side that currently has no power? If rules don't apply to the powerful, there can never be peace. And even if a new country of Palestine is allowed to exist and were empowered, there's a provision that now exists in U.S. law that makes it a lot harder for the Palestinians most likely to be empowered by the rest of the world. So first, to get the obvious out of the way, the government funding law prohibits funding of Hamas or any power-sharing government that shares power with Hamas. The emergency supplemental empowers the president then to sanction anyone, including foreign governments, who fund Hamas. Understandable, good, fine, fuck them. But the government funding law also prohibits any funding of the Palestine Liberation Organization, which is an organization formed in 1964 by the Arab League that includes several organizations, such as Fatah and the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. And so prohibiting funding of the PLO prohibits funding of a bunch of other Palestinian groups that had nothing to do with October 7th. Now, that's not to say that there's no violence in their history. There definitely is. The PLO, when it was founded in the 1960s, did advocate violence against Israel and committed hundreds of terrorist attacks, including the awful terrorist attack against Jewish athletes at the 1972 Munich Olympics. But the PLO also has a history of diplomacy as well. Because in the 1990s, Yasser Arafat was the PLO leader who negotiated the Oslo Accords in 1993. And in those negotiations, Yasser Arafat, as the Palestinian representative, recognized Israel's right to exist, and in return, the PLO was recognized as the legitimate representative of the Palestinian people. And since then, Mahmoud Abbas has been the head of the PLO, and under his leadership, the PLO has gained some legitimacy in the world, specifically in the conference room of the world, the United Nations. Since 2012, it's been over 12 years now, the Palestinians have been represented by the PLO and have been granted non-member observer status in the United Nations, which means that should Palestine be allowed to exist, it's the PLO that would be the group most likely to be accepted as legitimate in the world community because it's already halfway there. But with this law, that same group, which represents the Palestinians at the UN, is legally treated the same as Hamas. The only organization within Palestine which this law leaves a crack in the door open for is the Palestinian Authority. Now, the Palestinian Authority is the Palestinian group created by the PLO, which since the late 1990s has sort of governed the West Bank, which is the part of Palestine which is effectively controlled by Israel. It's occupied and policed by the Israeli Defense Forces. And it's the part of Palestine where Israel's government is building roads that Palestinians are not allowed to use, which chop up their communities, and where Israel's government is allowing its citizens to steal West Bank Palestinian land bit by bit. Well, the new law also prohibits funding to the Palestinian Authority, but that prohibition can be waived by the president. So that's the crack. A presidential waiver might allow cooperation with the Palestinian Authority, which is currently co-governing in the West Bank. But in effect, the structure of this law seems to indicate that out of the three organizations that have sort of governed Palestine in the last few decades, only the Palestinian Authority, which has allowed Israeli land grabbers to constantly take more land in the West Bank with no effective pushback whatsoever, and which does not currently represent the Palestinians in the conference room of the world, the United Nations. The Palestinian Authority, the weakest one, that's the only organization that our government seems willing to work with, so long as this is the law of our land. And speaking of the Palestinian Authority, and in another provision that seems aimed at the wrong people, There is also a new provision in our law that prohibits funding for the West Bank and Gaza until the Secretary of State certifies that, quote, steps are being taken by the Palestinian Authority to end torture and other cruel, inhumane, and degrading treatment of detainees, including by bringing justice to members of the Palestinian security forces who commit such crimes, unquote. Which, again, is all fine and good, but there's no similar provision for Israel. And this is a problem, and this has been a problem since before October 7th. Because in July of 2023, the UN Human Rights Council received testimony from an independent expert, their special rapporteur on the situation of human rights in the Palestinian territory, who said that months before October 7th, there were 5,000 Palestinians in Israeli prisons, including 160 children, and approximately 1,100 of them were being held essentially hostage, without charges or scheduled trials. And we also need to keep in mind when thinking of charges and trials that there are two systems of justice in the territories that Israel fully controls, which includes the West Bank part of Palestine. According to that UN report, the Israeli military wrote and enforces martial laws that only apply to Palestinians, while Israeli domestic law applies to Jewish Israeli settlers in the West Bank, even though all of these people live in the same piece of land. According to the UN report, quote, this draconian legal regime lay the foundation of a coercive environment whereby Palestinians were constantly at risk of being imprisoned, often by carrying out the simplest acts of life, from farming, fishing, or going to school, but also opposing the occupation. Children, liable to imprisonment as of 12 years of age, were treated as inhumanely and lawlessly as adults, unquote. The report also said, in general, that the occupied Palestinian territory had been transformed as a whole into a constantly surveilled open-air prison. Her report said, quote, detention was being used as a tool to stop those within the occupied territory from exercising their rights. There were also threats, blackmail, assault, and medical negligence being used against detainees, as well as their transfer outside of the occupied territories. These practices amounted to flagrant violations of the Hague Convention, the Geneva Convention, and humanitarian law, and constituted crimes against humanity and war crimes, unquote. And the situation is pretty much the same, except it's only gotten worse since October 7th. Much worse. In a United Nations report dated February 19th, experts who are part of the UN's independent fact-finding body who are appointed by the Human Rights Council, who are not UN staff and do not receive any salary, they did an independent investigation and they say that, quote, they express concern about the arbitrary detention of hundreds of Palestinian women and girls, including human rights defenders, journalists, and humanitarian workers in Gaza and the West Bank since the 7th of October. Many have reportedly been subjected to inhumane and degrading treatment, denied menstruation pads, food, and medicine, and severely beaten. On at least one occasion, Palestinian women detained in Gaza were allegedly kept in a cage in the rain and cold without food. We are particularly distressed by reports that Palestinian women and girls in detention have also been subjected to multiple forms of sexual assault, such as being stripped naked and searched by male Israeli army officers. At least two female Palestinian detainees were reportedly raped, while others were reportedly threatened with rape and sexual violence, unquote. They also noted that photos of female detainees in degrading circumstances were also taken by the Israeli army and uploaded online. And yes, after these UN reports were made public, our Congress included no provisions demanding Israel respect the human rights of their detainees. Only the Palestinians have to adhere to these very basic standards in return for our tax money. And since that law was signed, we have gotten even more information from a CNN investigation that provided damning evidence that Israelis are torturing people now. According to the CNN Investigations Team report, three military bases have been at least partially converted to detention camps that hold Palestinian hostages taken from their homes and held indefinitely with no charges after October 7th, which is a practice that was quietly legalized in December within Israel via its new unlawful combatants law. Does that terminology sound familiar? But the new law allows the Israeli government to detain people for a month and a half, for 45 days, without an arrest warrant, after which these people have to be released or transferred to Israel's formal prison system, assuming they survive. But as of the release of the report on May 10th, the estimation is that over 9,000 Palestinians are currently being held in Israel's prisons, but the total number of humans being held in the new military detention bases is unknown. But one new detention center in particular is drawing a lot of attention, and that is Sedi Tayman, I apologize if I am saying that incorrectly, but it is a desert military base 18 miles from the Gaza border inside of Israel. Inside of Israel, that is now used as a detention center. And this was the subject of the CNN investigation that was published in mid-May. But three brave Israelis who worked at the camp and were horrified by what they were participating in, gave photos to journalists showing rows of men in gray sweats, blindfolded, and forbidden from moving or talking. These photos remind me way too much of the photos taken at Abu Ghraib. And the images corroborate the information given by Palestinians who have gotten out of detention since October 7th. For example, the head of the surgical unit at Northern Gaza's Indonesian hospital was arrested in December, and he reported upon his release that when arrested, he was forced to undress down to his underwear, had his wrists tied, and then he was piled on top of other damn near naked detainees on the back of a truck as they were driven somewhere in the desert, which is a story that has been similarly told by dozens of others who were arrested in the same way. Once in the camps, prisoners who have been released also reported being blindfolded for most of their detention, which is a form of torture. Prisoners are also being beaten with no intelligence gathering goal. The beatings, according to, you know, the Dr. McDreamy of Gaza, they were caused by a person speaking or moving, and the beatings he saw were so severe that teeth and bones were broken. This was also something that was reiterated by the Israeli whistleblowers. The doctor also described prisoners who had their limbs amputated because of constant handcuffing, and he was ordered to perform medical procedures without giving the patients anesthesia. But after the medical procedures and beatings, the wounds are apparently being left untreated, and some were so infected that they're making the whole prison smell. But the lucky ones who do get medical treatment are apparently strapped to their beds, where they're put in diapers, blindfolded, and fed through straws. And those who aren't so lucky, like the head of the orthopedic wing at Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, Dr. Adnan Al-Bersh, well, he was taken by the Israelis in December, is believed to have been tortured and beaten during interrogation, and he died in an Israeli prison. He's one of 18 known prisoners to have died in Israeli custody since October 8th. Which, finally, brings me to a new U.S. law that prohibits funding to the Palestinian Authority that absolutely makes my blood boil. And that's a provision that prohibits economic support for the Palestinian Authority if the Palestinians request an investigation by the International Criminal Court into any Israeli citizens' alleged crimes against Palestinians. Not that they really need to request that investigation, since the International Criminal Court prosecutor has already announced that he wants to issue arrest warrants for three Hamas leaders and two Israeli officials, Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, all of them credibly accused of war crimes. And not that our government really operates within the rules-based international order ourselves, because the International Criminal Court was created in 1998, and while our country, during the Clinton administration, was a key player in creating it, we never actually joined it because we didn't want the court to be able to prosecute Americans for our war crimes. We are only one of seven countries that voted against its creation. And this means for all the squawking our leaders do, especially Joe Biden, about the importance about the rules-based international order, we don't actually recognize the world as having a judicial system at all. We have even sanctioned, as in declared economic war, against International Criminal Court officials for daring to try to prosecute American soldiers for war crimes, which, let's be real, we know Americans have committed. I have the Abu Ghraib pictures burned into my memory. And so our new law takes that system and says Palestinians should not have access to it, says that they can't even request an investigation if they want to be a real country. On top of that, the new law also prohibits funding for the United Nations International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, including East Jerusalem and Israel, which is an investigation that has been ongoing since May of 2021. It's been 3 years now, and has been independently investigating systematic discrimination and repression based on national, ethnic, and religious identity, which seems like a legitimate investigation to me, considering Israel is a proud Jewish country that has been bulldozing Arab homes and building Jewish cities in Palestinian territory out in the open. They aren't even trying to hide it. Like I said before, and I'll say it over and over again, none of this started on October 7th. And because none of Israel's shameful behavior towards the Palestinians is new, because there have been multiple not a real wars against Gaza where the caged population has been repeatedly bombed with no means for the people to escape. And because Israel has long prohibited the people of Gaza from having enough construction supplies and food and clean water to meet their needs, and because Israel has long bulldozed Palestinian homes and allowed so-called settlers, aka land grabbers, to injure and kill Palestinians with no consequences, because Israel has been doing this for decades, the United Nations has been investigating the Israeli government for decades. And this Congress, instead of trying to use their financial leverage over Israel to get them to stop the crimes against humanity, our Congress is instead trying to get the investigations to stop. Specifically, our law now prohibits funding for the UN Human Rights Council unless it takes significant steps to remove Israel as a permanent agenda item. Now, what this refers to is the fact that the United Nations Human Rights Council has 10 permanent agenda items that get regularly debated at least 3 times a year. And permanent agenda item number 7 is the only one that refers to a specific country, Israel. Specifically, its occupation of Palestine and other Arab territories, such as the Golan Heights in Syria. Since 2006, there have been approximately 90 UN Human Rights Council resolutions related to Israel. And while I didn't look at every single one of them, Israeli occupations, military violence, and land grabs are recurring themes. And based on the indisputable fact that Israel continues to occupy land that does not legally belong to it, is clearly using their military to commit heinous acts of violence, and land grabs are increasing in the West Bank, and time will tell if this Gaza operation is a giant land grab itself. But all of that makes it clear that these UN resolutions are being ignored by Israel's government. And so our Congress, instead of pressuring our dear, dear ally to stop ignoring the rules in this rules-based international order, our Congress has instead chosen to pressure the United Nations Human Rights Council to stop trying to regularly enforce the rules upon Israel, which fits our pattern of behavior in the United Nations. Clicking through the UN Human Rights Council resolutions, every single one that I looked at, the United States voted against. Even ones like the one from a year ago in April 2023, before October 7th, that basically said that Palestinians have a right to self-determination in an independent state of Palestine. As a country which has officially supported the two-state solution for decades, which we officially have, this resolution shouldn't be controversial and should be an easy yes vote. And this resolution was supported by many of our allies, Belgium, Finland, France, Germany, Mexico, Ukraine, but we voted against it. And perhaps the reason behind that is because the resolution calls upon all states to ensure their obligations of non-recognition, non-aid or assistance with regards to the serious breaches of preemptory norms of international law by Israel, in particular the prohibition of the acquisition of territory by force, in order to ensure the exercise of the right to self-determination, unquote. And we've seen how resistant American elites, President Biden, this Congress, we've seen how resistant they are to cutting off partnerships with Israel's government in corporate war profiteering. Clearly, Palestinian rights, their state in the two-state solution, all of that is less important than keeping the money flowing between American and Israeli companies. And again, this has been going on for a long time. Nothing has fundamentally changed. More of us are just aware of it now than we were before October 7th and the subsequent total destruction of Gaza. But how gross is it that our Congress would put up a hurdle to the Palestinians seeking justice via the international justice system? Like, if we don't allow Palestinians to seek justice non-violently via the rules-based international order, what option do they have left to get justice and to fight for their human rights? When they don't have access to justice, they're going to use violence. It's all they have left. And just looking at ourselves for a second, how can we say that we are a country committed to justice, to that rules-based international order, if we are legally punishing people for using that system? The hypocrisy is disgusting, and the strategy is terrifying, because they are pretty much guaranteeing that the cycle of violence has to continue. As they say, for a reason, no justice, no peace. The whole world seems to know that there are only two real solutions to the Israel and Palestine problem. And keeping the people of Gaza caged and allowing Israel to keep stealing West Bank land bit by bit is not on the list. The things that will solve this are, one, Israel can become what has long claimed to be a democracy and allow everyone under its control to have the same rights and to allow them all to vote. This is the one-state solution. The problem is, if the millions of Arabs who live on the land that Israelis think was gifted to them by God, if millions of Arabs who are Muslims and Christians are allowed to vote in a single state of Israel, then Israel probably won't remain a Jewish state. There's a reason why no real democracy is also a theocracy, especially when the religion in the center of the government claims that its members are chosen by God above all others. It doesn't work. Israel can be a democracy or an ethno-state. It can't be both, which it's proving in real time. But the reason that Israel was created in the first place was for it to be an ethno-state, for it to be a religion-based government. And even though that is directly in conflict with the freedom of religion that our country officially values, the elites in our government have supported Israel as a Jewish supremacist country every step of the way. Which, fine, I don't care. I don't live there and I never will. But that means that the 1947 UN resolution, which we have long officially supported, needs to be completed. And the Arab state of Palestine needs to become a real thing. That's the two-state solution. That has long been our official U.S. policy. Our official U.S. goal in Israel is to create a Palestine. But this law puts up a lot of hurdles to make that two-state solution harder, not easier. All of the requirements are placed upon the powerless, are placed upon the Palestinians, while the powerful, the Israelis, are given enormous amounts of money and weapons with no requirements that they live up to their United Nations obligations whatsoever. These new laws do nothing to end the cycle of violence by solving the land dispute once and for all, by telling Israel to be happy with the borders that they have, with the country that they have, and using our financial leverage to stop Israel from stealing additional land. At some point, someone in a position of real power needs to tell the Israelis that God didn't give them sh**, that the Bible is not how we determine property rights in 2024. The United Nations has repeatedly, for decades, said that the borders of Israel are the borders that were established after the 1967 war, which is a gift to Israel. That is way more territory than they were supposed to get in the UN resolution that was passed in 1947. And there is like a weird property sharing arrangement for Jerusalem that was worked out and all that as well. But the 1967 borders, those are Israel's borders. Israel exists. It has land, and no one with actual power is trying to take that away from them. What needs to be done is that Israel needs to live in peace with what they have. And the Palestinians, you don't get to return. I know it sucks. I know it's not fair. But generations of Israelis have been raised on the land since 1948, and they don't deserve to be kicked out of their homes either. The Palestinians should be given full rights of a real country in the West Bank and Gaza. They should be free to elect whoever they damn well please to represent them in their new government. They should control their own borders. They should be able to sign international trade agreements. They should have a proportional share of the massive fossil fuel wealth off of their shores. And they shouldn't have to get Israel's permission for any of it. You know, when this topic comes up, so often the familiar cop-out is, well, it's just so complicated. This can never really be solved. But it really isn't all that complicated. There is a piece of land and two groups of people want it. And the solution is crystal clear. You learned it in kindergarten. They need to share. One group cannot have total dominance over the other, because that is occupation and repression. And one group cannot kick the other one out, because that is ethnic cleansing. They have to share. It's not complicated. And our leaders know it because it has been our official policy that we need to facilitate that sharing for decades. But these new laws don't do that. These new laws make everything worse, by enabling the powerful, lawless occupiers and putting impossible conditions upon those with no power to change the situation. And they did this in our names. Instead of working to stop the cycle of violence with a real solution, our members of Congress and President Biden have chosen to do what they can to hide the cycle of violence, especially the violence committed by Israel, from us as best they can. Because the government funding law in March also prohibits any money from being given to the Palestinian Broadcasting Corporation. Since 1996, the Palestinian Broadcasting Corporation has been operating Palestine TV, a radio station known as the Voice of Palestine, and a satellite channel, which can be seen around the world, which is known as the Palestinian Satellite Channel. And the United States government actually partially funded it for its first 2 years. But in 2002, the IDF bombed and destroyed its five-story main headquarters and transmission tower in the West Bank after a Palestinian gunman who had nothing to do with the Palestine Broadcasting Corporation killed six Israelis. Now, the IDF said that the journalists at the Palestinian Broadcasting Corporation were guilty of incitement, and that's why they destroyed the headquarters and main transmission tower, in a move that was condemned by the United Nations and media organizations all over the world. And now here we are 21 years later, before October 7th, and the Palestine Broadcasting Corporation found itself being accused of incitement again because of its reporting of news from a Palestinian perspective. Specifically, they reported on Israel's truly psychotic National Security Minister Ben-Gvir, who ordered the Voice of Palestine radio station, the official radio station of the Palestinian Authority, which co-governs the West Bank along with Israeli soldiers and is the one entity that we might consider working with if there was a real Palestinian country. Well, they ordered the official radio station of the Palestinian Authority to be closed and prohibited the broadcast from being heard anywhere within Israel. And instead of pressuring Israel to follow our First Amendment values and allow the Palestinian Authority to have their broadcasting corporation back, instead, the U.S. Congress is prohibiting funding that had long been cut off anyway. But it just goes to show how one-sided this Congress's support in this conflict is. And all of the support is for the already powerful. Israel does something that goes directly against the values in our First Amendment to the Constitution. And instead of encouraging them to be better, we partner with them in silencing Palestinian voices. And along those lines, I just have to mention that the so-called only democracy in the Middle East has been even more brazen in their banning of media lately. This happened a couple weeks ago on May 5th. This is Al Jazeera English reporter Imran Khan in a segment that was aired on Cinco de Drinco.
If you're watching this pre-recorded report, then Al Jazeera has been banned in the territory of Israel. On April the 1st, the Knesset, the Israeli parliament, passed a law that allowed the prime minister to ban Al Jazeera. He's now enacted that law. Let me just take you through some of the definitions within the law. They've banned our website, including anything that has the option of entering or accessing the website, even passwords that are needed, whether they're paid or not, and whether it's stored on Israeli servers or outside of Israel. The website is now inaccessible. They're also banning any device used for providing content. That includes my mobile phone. If I use that to do any kind of news gathering, then the Israelis can simply confiscate it. Our internet access provider, the guy that simply hosts AlJazeera.net, is also in danger of being fined if they host the website. The Al Jazeera TV channel, completely banned. Transmission by any kind of content provider is also banned. And holding offices or operating them in the territory of Israel by the channel. Also, once again, any devices used to provide content for the channel can be taken away by the Israelis. It's a wide-ranging ban. We don't know how long it will be in place for, but it does cover this territory of the state of Israel.
And I do think it's important to understand what this means within Israel, because I live in a country that has done horrible things in my adult voting age, which I do not support and which weren't done in my name. You know, we overthrew Iraq for no good reason and killed hundreds of thousands of people at a minimum. We tortured people. We drone bomb whoever our leaders label a terrorist, much like Israel's leaders are bombing whoever they label as Hamas. They're using our playbook. And I don't think that all of us Americans are monsters because of what our government does. And that goes for Israelis, too. You know, I know a lot of the history that I have recently learned about Israel's creation and its past is not common knowledge in the United States nor in Israel. They are not taught about their country's sins, much like I wasn't taught about our genocide of the Native Americans until I went looking for the information. And right now, Israel is hiding information from its own citizens. Here's a segment of an interview from, this is also May 5th, on Al Jazeera English. And this was recorded just after Israeli law enforcement had raided Al Jazeera's offices, stole their equipment, and shut them down inside Israel. This interview is with Gideon Levy. He's a born and raised Israeli journalist who focuses his work often on the relationship between Israel and Palestine. And he's very well respected. In fact, he won Israel's top award for journalism in 2021. And this is what he says is the current media environment within Israel.
So what does the war look like as seen and as presented by Israeli media to Israelis?
Very, very simple picture. We are the victims. We are the only victims, as usual. There was the 7th of October, and we will stick to the 7th of October, which was almost the Holocaust in the eyes of most of the Israelis. And this 7th of October enabled us and legitimized us to do whatever we want in Gaza. Gaza doesn't interest us. Gaza is Hamas, and Hamas is Gaza. And therefore, we should punish them all, and if possible, even kill them all, destroy them all. And we have no interest to see what's the suffer of Gaza, what's the punishment of Gaza, what the innocent people of Gaza are going through. We are only interested in the brave soldiers, the hostages, and the victims of the 7th of October. That's our world, and that's the world that the Israeli media as a whole is describing to its viewers for 7 months now, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day. Only this. You don't see Gaza.
So as angry as we are, or at least than I am, but I know that I am not alone in this, but as angry as we are at the Israeli government, I do think we need to have some empathy for the Israeli citizens, because we're just like them. Their government is hiding what they are doing. And so let's remember that when we hear about the polls, about how so many Israelis support the destruction of Gaza. They don't know what's going on there. We have to have empathy for everyone who doesn't know things. On this particular issue, the hiding of information has been systemic in Israel and in the United States. Because going back, events that happened decades ago, like I said, I didn't know. And I say this to encourage you to approach this topic with empathy and with calm if you can. I encourage you to first try and gauge, does this person you are talking to or about know what is going on now or in the past? I encourage you to have empathy for those who don't, because screaming at someone doesn't help anyone learn. This issue is more difficult than most to talk about. And in my experience, the education gap on this one is huge. I had to study this for months to finally feel like I understand it enough to speak about it. And I didn't want to know until I wanted to know. But there were seeds that were planted in my head by people who did know and who didn't yell at me. Everyone who planted a seed of curiosity in my head did so by talking about this in a way that didn't attack me for not knowing. You know, at this point, I hate to say this, but it's true. But at this point, we are powerless to change what our government has done in regards to Israel and Palestine. They've done the law. It's now election time. What's done is done, because this Congress, it's almost over, and they clearly don't give a fuck what we think. But what you can do as an individual is plant seeds of education. You can have the tough conversations and be kind to each other, no matter who you are speaking to, because you don't know what they don't know, and you don't know what you don't know. But the only thing that I know is that Americans and Palestinians and Israelis, the people of all of these countries and the not a country, the people have more in common than we're told. You know, follow Bisan on social media. She's an independent journalist in Gaza doing amazing work. And I don't know that she was a journalist before all of this started happening. She's a young girl. And she, in addition to sharing her fear and her sorrow, she also shared that she loves chocolates and flowers. She's also sharing her joy. She's just like me. And she's been living on the streets for 7 months, dodging bombs and having to start every one of her posts with the phrase, "I am still alive." I love this girl. She's not a terrorist. And the children she interviews and cares for are not terrorists. They're just like us. And the Israeli soldiers who are being sent to do horrible things in Gaza, who were drafted by their government, they are just like our friends who were sent to fight illegal wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. They are serving their country, right or wrong. They are also just like us. We are all in this together. And who we should collectively focus our anger on is on the small group of powerful people ruling the world and who treat all of us like toys in their power games. Because you do not deserve to die because of Biden's actions, or Trump's, or George W. Bush's. And Israelis do not deserve to die because of Netanyahu's actions. And Palestinians do not deserve to die because of Hamas's actions. Our leaders, all of our leaders, are playing games of money and power. And we normies, people who aren't power and money-hungry freaks, we suffer the consequences of their games that we don't really want to participate in. Our united anger should be directed at them, not at protesters, and not at people with a Star of David around their necks. Our anger should be directed at those in power. This is all their fault. And we will only defeat them when we stop fighting with each other. And with that, I'm going to move away from this subject for a while. You know, unless there is some major legislative development, of course. But you now know what is United States law. And I think we can follow the developments on this on our own. Because I need to turn my attention to other areas of government, as Israel's destruction of Gaza has consumed me now, both personally and professionally, for 7 straight months. And there are other events happening in this Congress that deserve attention. But I obviously care too much to look away, and I will still be tweeting and retweeting relevant news updates on my Twitter feed, so you can follow me at Jen Briney and at Congress Ditch. And you can follow me on Instagram at Jen Briney and at Congressional Dish. And I do recommend that you follow both because I'm in charge of the accounts with my name on them, but my wonderful assistant Claire is running the Congressional Dish accounts. So they're not just repeats of each other. And as for updates on the news on Gaza and Israel in podcast form, I know I'm going to be listening to Rising, because as long as Breonna Joy Gray is a host, I know the subject will not be ignored. And I know that Robbie Suave is not going to allow the Israeli perspective to be ignored. I think they have done a really good job of balancing each other out on this really tough conversation. And I admire their work on this. Speaking of admiring their work, Intercepted, which is the Intercepts podcast, has also done really important in-depth coverage as well. And if screen time is your thing, I do have to recommend Al Jazeera English. They've done excellent work because even though they've been booted out of Israel, they've had reporters on the ground in Gaza since October 7th. And so they've been able to report on the ground there the whole time, even with Israel's blockade on any journalists entering the Gaza cage. But to be honest, it's Bisson's account that I check every day. She's the best on-the-ground source of information that I know of. So seriously, please follow her. She's an incredible human being, and I put links to all of these sources in the show notes for you. Yeah, this has been a really tough topic to discuss, to focus on, to study. And before I wrap up this episode and thank our executive producer, I do just want to thank you for listening, because I know that this is a depressing topic. I know it's horrific. I know it's easier to look away. And I'm happy that you haven't looked away. I do think we need to know what our government is doing in our names. And I know that sometimes listening to this podcast is like eating your vegetables, and that's what you've done today. So thank you for listening. And, you know, if you want to plant the seed for someone else, please share this episode in particular. I do think that the beginning of the war money episode is important, but this episode tells you what became law. This tells you what our Congress and our president did about it. This is the episode that I think people can vote with. So please share the episode. And of course, please support the show financially. The show has taken a financial hit for for me talking about this topic in 3 different episodes, but it is what it is. There's certain things that need to be said. And sometimes those are hard. And that's why we do this funding model, because I can tell you what I believe to be the truth, even when it upsets everyone, even when it upsets people I care about, even when it upsets people I love. Yeah, I had to tell you the truth as I see it. So that's what I've done. So thank you for supporting this. Thank you for listening. And we're not going to do the little music thing this time, but real quick, I do want to thank our executive producer. And this is a name I'm really excited to see added to the executive producer list. If you are new to our funding model, we have executive producers that determine which episodes are listed highest on the most valuable episodes list. And you can become an executive producer giving your vouch to the episode for $535 cumulative dollars. And you can do that either one time, or you can do it the way Ed Sitchin has done it, which is consistently supporting the show with, I believe, $7 for years. And it has now added up to him being an executive producer of the show. And it makes me very excited to see a name that I'm so familiar with to be an executive producer. And so he sent in a message with his new executive producer credit. And he said, I've been debating what episode to choose for weeks, but I think I'll go with the Inflation Reduction Act. While I've heard the implementation has been less than awesome, this episode was great because it was both useful and a fantastic reminder that government doesn't always have to suck horrible, horrible donkey shit. It can and should do good things. I commend Jen for doing a far better job than anyone else I saw in the media on the actual law itself, as opposed to the politics of it. That's why Congressional Dish is always so great. I'm super stoked to finally have an executive producer credit, and thank you for all of your amazing work. Well, thank you for supporting the show for so long, and I'm really glad to announce your credit on the Inflation Reduction Act episode, because it is a reminder, especially after just talking for, I don't know how long this episode's going to be, but it feels like 15 hours. But after just talking about Congress doing things that make me very ashamed, the Inflation Reduction Act episode actually helped people. If you haven't heard it yet, you should probably listen to it soon, because there's a lot of money in there that can help you make your own home much more energy efficient. Money that I don't think the mainstream media talked about at all. So there's a lot of money just sitting on the table. And that's, I think, what he means by the implementation being less than awesome, because the media didn't do their job in telling us that there was all this cash, all this opportunity where the government is investing in your home so that we as a country use less energy. I actually really liked that bill, and it wasn't from this Congress, or I should say law. It wasn't from this Congress, but it was one of the episodes that reminds me that Congress can be a force for good, even if this particular Congress is not. So yeah, thank you, Ed, for supporting the show for all these years. Thank you to all the producers for supporting the show for all these years. Thank you, as always, to my amazing team, Mike, Claire, Lauren, Mark, Daryl. All of you are my team, even for listening to this. Thank you. I'm glad I at least got to tell you what I needed to tell you about Palestine before moving on to other topics. Having the ability to do this job does help me sleep at night, and I hope sharing it and supporting it helps you sleep at night as well. So yeah, thank you so much. I don't know what the next episode is going to be, but I'll get it to you as soon as I can. Thanks again. I'll talk to you soon. Bye.
We don't have a domestic spying program.
They're content to fight in black and white despite the many in-betweens. We got a president who plays with the facts.
With the facts.
And then he waves a flag to cover his tracks. As if a lie is all right, if the end will justify the means. Now we are so damn tired of being lied to.
The polar ice caps aren't going away.
We don't.
Government jobs consume the profits of the private sector.
We don't think we can deny it anymore. You can stick to your story if you think it flies. But we're not keeping quiet anymore.
These bills represent common sense, bipartisan solutions that actually solve problems.